This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Half. There's a lot of farmers on tractors at the moment trying to get a crop off before that rain does come across the state. We'll have more on what the weather will hold in the next half hour. Also, there's been a lot of focus on the demise of manufacturing in this country, particularly in this state. But what about the food and grocery manufacturing?
So food and grocery manufacturing generally has been resilient. We have done better than the broader manufacturing sector, which has suffered much greater declines in employment and turnover. So we have been holding our own, but there are some concerns for the future outlook of the sector.
We'll take a look at a new report from the Food and Grocery Council. We'll also get a wrap of how Australian Wool Innovations AGM finished up last week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can on 0467 922 783 or give us a call on 1300 222 891. Right now, it is 6 minutes past 12. And we'll head across now to State Parliament because tomorrow the Minister for Mining and Energy has listed a bill to amend the state's Mining Act. Now, it's not the final sign-off, but it progresses what has been a controversial bill. Agriculture lobby groups have been pushing to see farmers on prime agriculture land be given the ability to veto mining on their land in this new iteration of the Act. That hasn't happened. I'm joined by Wade Dabinett from Grain Producers SA. Wade, the Minister can really be under no illusion that GPSA wants farmers to be given this veto power over arable land. This hasn't happened. So is it basically case closed for you?
How are you going, Cass? Yep, thanks for having me on. Members will have just received an update. I think we've only just emailed it out, providing them any information on where we see it. Those that picked up the Saturday paper on the weekend would be probably quite shocked to hear that it looks like the minister's trying to progress the bill in which he tabled in August. Yes, the question around whether or not he's been listening. Well, it appears not. He's going to pass the bill, and yet there's been no substantive changes in the bill in which we've been calling for consistently now. I've been involved with GPSA for 6 years, and we've been beating this drum the whole time, and it just appears that that it hasn't been picked up. Although, heartening, there appears to be a number of regional and backbench MPs that do agree with us.
And I understand they are meeting in Cabinet today. I haven't been able to get on to any of the members who have been supposedly said that they might cross the floor on this. But given that farmers don't own what's under the ground and really no farmers in Australia have been given veto powers, carte blanche in any state to be able to veto mining on their land, why did GPSA really think that this government would support the idea of giving farmers veto power?
Well, I mean, let's cast our mind back to this time last year. The government now actually blocked the Labor's legislation, which is almost a mirror image of what the current minister has introduced. So, and they did make a commitment, pre-election commitment, to consult. The bill that was tabled in August was we hadn't seen a draft of that, so it took everyone by surprise. And I think it is a bit strange that we've been talking about this issue for such a period of time. We've got rising tensions with mining trying to access agricultural land, and there has been some conflicts in which do raise a lot of concerns that the rights between mining and agriculture aren't right. We're seeing, a lot of our members racking up significant legal bills, and just a lot of that too is just trying to gain information. So the balance certainly isn't right, and we've been pushing for a long period of time that the right of veto, we believe, provides that balance. There needs to be, greater consideration for the economic impact of what agriculture has to the state. It just really shocks us, I suppose, that we've had a change of government, and you would think that a party in which its constituents that has a significant amount of constituents in rural and regional areas, and you apply the same that incoming government's principles, and yet they come up with the same result as the previous Labor government, it just seems a bit odd to me. So we've sort of lost confidence in the whole process of consultation, and we've consistently said that there should be an independent inquiry outside of the department to look at the land access provisions of the bill. That was a key policy that featured in our election strategy, and that has not changed. And now, given that this debate has continued, the bill hasn't addressed our concerns, there seems to be rising discontent within the Liberal Party. Surely it's time to actually have an independent look at this so we actually get the balance right.
But there is a difference between a lack of consultation and just not getting what you want. Is this just because you're not getting what you want?
Well, I mean, we've got nothing to do with what's happening within the Liberal Party. We've been consistent with our push for what the agricultural sector needs for a long period of time. As I said, there's plenty of examples out there in which, conflicts are happening between exploration and mining that just don't make sense. I mean, agriculture has been the largest industry for this state for a long period of time. We'll continue into the future. I challenge the views that mining alone is the big growth opportunity. You know, we talk all the time about the growth in the agricultural sector and food. So I don't think that we should just sort of, put up the white flag and allow mining just to buy out agricultural land. Because once an open cut mine buys a farm, it's never going to go back into agricultural production. So we've been consistent on it.
Could this open up a can of worms, though? Say you do get the veto power, but one farmer still allows mining on their property that is in the arable area, and they're next door to someone who has vetoed that. Do you see that actually creating more conflict?
Well, I mean, we're about protecting the individual's freedom to operate. So, we're not saying that no mining at all in agricultural land. That we're saying that should be left to the landowner to decide. At the moment, if the landowner says no, I don't want you to access my land, so then the mining company can take them to court. And there's not enough direction within the legislation that says, well, agriculture actually needs to be considered in terms of what the economic impact is going to be. At the moment, if it goes into court, unfortunately, the farmer's worse off. So, I mean, you've got to ask yourself, if you as a farmer want to buy out the neighbour who doesn't want to sell, what do you have to do? You have to pay a significant premium to get access to that land. And yet in the scenario of a mine wanting to buy up land, that's not the case. They can take them to court. It can be a lengthy process. So it's not even commercial when you look at real-life examples of actually just trying to buy out a neighbour's property. It's a disgrace, and it needs to change.
We're speaking to Wade Davenant, who is the Chair of Grand Producers SA. We'd love to know what you think about this topic of whether farmers should be granted the power of veto on prime agricultural land. You can text in on 0467 922 783. It's a sort of a flipped situation from this time 2 years ago when Labor put up, as you've said, Wade, a practically identical bill. Have you approached Labor? Do you see any traction there now, given that the Liberal Party only holds the government by about 2 seats?
Yeah, look, I mean, our only way to progress is since August, when the bill was tabled, is to engage with Liberal backbenchers, opposition and crossbenchers to make sure our views are known across the political spectrum, because the only way we can actually fix the land tax positions is via amendments to the bill. So we've been doing that since August, and we'll continue to do that. As I said, it's heartening that that some are listening. Given the article that was in the Advertiser on Saturday, we think, as we have always said, we think the best way forward on this is to have an independent inquiry. So a review of the current bill, independent of the department, because our members and us have actually lost a lot of confidence in the consultation, because you say, okay, well, we're just continuing to agitate because they're not listening. Well, yes, because they haven't actually made any fundamental changes at all in this current bill. So you know, we'll continue to hold our position of right of veto because we think that's what should happen. I'm just amazed that they haven't even made any changes whatsoever to address any of the conflicts and the examples that we've been talking about for the last 6 years. So if the department's not listening, the current minister's not listening, the previous government's listening, let's take it outside of the department and away from the minister and actually give us some independence around this. Once and for all, everyone gets an opportunity to have their say and we can move on.
Thanks for that, Wade. That was Wade Davenant, who is the chair of Grain Producers SA. Yeah, we would love to know what you think. You can text in on 0467 922 783 on whether you think a veto is the right idea or whether there should be the opportunity for mining to take place over the entire area of South Australia. We did put in calls to speak with the mining minister, Dan Van Hulst Pelican, and also with some of the backbenchers who have reportedly thought about crossing the floor, and we will try to follow up on that tomorrow as well. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's 12:15. Moving away from mining now to manufacturing, where the food and grocery manufacturers are warning a decline in their industry could mean the loss of local jobs. A new report out today highlights a worrying drop in investment and turnover in the $131 billion industry. While exports are helping stem major losses, the industry wants to buck the broader decline of manufacturing in Australia. Marty McCarthy reports.
It's a sweet day at the Robert Menz Chocolate Factory in Adelaide.
Well, what we're looking at right now is 77,000 Violet Crumble bars on its way to the US. We're really excited about this because we just see some great, enormous opportunities in high-value markets overseas.
CEO Phil Sims says the company is exporting its chocolate direct to the United States for the first time.
Well, when you're talking about the United States, I mean, you're talking about 320 million people, a huge market that love their candy.
While optimism here is high, that's not the case in Australia's wider food manufacturing industry. A new report out today by the Australian Food and Grocery Council has found capital investment by manufacturers has fallen dramatically by 10%. The council's CEO, Tanya Barden.
We have seen that capital investment is now at the second lowest point that it's been in the last 10 years, and that really goes to the future sustainability of manufacturing in this country. So food and grocery manufacturing generally has been resilient. We have done better than the broader manufacturing sector, which has suffered much greater declines in employment and turnover. So we have been holding our own, but there are some concerns for the future outlook of the sector.
An 8% boost in the value of exported processed food and groceries helped shield the industry from any major losses. Despite that, annual turnover still decreased by 2%, a loss of $2.7 billion.
The industry has certainly been facing some significant challenges in recent years, and that's particularly focused around the big increases in energy prices, transportation, wages, and then also seeing some cost increases coming through now as a result of the drought.
Owen Pope from Pope Jams in Townsville, who relies on produce grown in North Queensland, says many food producers are tightening their belts as production costs rise.
There's a lot of competition with food coming into the country. There's a lot of competition. Most of the jams and pickle manufacturing that was done in Australia has gone to New Zealand. And we need to become more efficient in our operations. We need, you know, I'm a firm believer in the open market, but that means that we have to be more efficient.
Back in Adelaide, Mr. Sims says it's important food businesses invest and grow to ensure jobs stay local, and so too does the food.
If we sort of get to a situation where we're relying on product that's coming in from overseas when we're unsure about the environment that the ingredients are coming from and how the conditions that they're grown in, I think Australians are concerned by that. We have a very viable food industry in Australia, and I think it's important that it stays that way.
That was confectioner Phil Sims ending Marty McCarthy's report there. And we have had some texts come in on this topic of giving farmers veto power. And we have an anonymous text saying the power of veto for farmers. Absolutely. And yes, you can't eat minerals except what we get in food from Dave. Thanks so much for those texts. We'd still love to know what you think about this idea. You can text in on 0467 922 783 on whether or not this idea that farmers should be given veto power, not necessarily a carte blanche blanket, but farmers should be able to, if they are in arable land, be able to say yes or no to mining on their property. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. It is 19 minutes past 12.
Hi there, Mif Warhurst here, just popping my head in to let you know what's coming up on the show. We take a sneak peek in the Adelaide Time Capsule, learn the surprising history of Muzak. Yep, elevator music. And what makes a place great? Placemaking is a thing now, and it's happening all around Australia. Wherever you are in Australia, blow the froth off one with me, Mif Warhurst, lunchtimes on ABC Radio.
Australian Wool Innovation have put off the last few contentious recommendations of the Ernst & Young review called for by the federal government, and the organisation's controversial chairman, Wal Merriman, has quietly stepped into the shade. The man in the mirror stood down from the chairman's role recently and didn't utter a word at this year's AGM in Sydney, as David Claughton reports.
It's been a tough year for Wal Merriman and the wool industry's research and marketing body. His handling of several governance issues and the media triggered the federal review, and he's paid the price. Lauded again at the AGM in Sydney as a giant of the wool industry, he was thanked by growers for his contribution. CEO Stuart McCulloch says Mr. Merriman's future on the board may be decided at an extraordinary general meeting next year.
The first thing we have to do is get through an EGM next year, which will preside over points that might affect that him going to election next year. But he's got some time too, you know. So there's a bit of water to go under the bridge yet before we get to November next year. Let's see how that goes, and largely that's his decision. Absolutely, his decision. Mm.
What about the wool levy result? That was, well, I don't know, a kick in the teeth is maybe too strong, but was it a surprise?
We thought that 1.5 would attract a good amount of votes. It's simply its proximity to 2. We thought that, you know, we knew that a lot of wool growers out there were doing it pretty tough with big feed bills at the moment. And we knew our reserves were very public and very high. I think it came down to Western Australia in the end. If you ask me whether it was a performance thing, then I don't really know. You know, in the order of 7,000 wool growers voted for 1.5%, and I'm not sure what was going through their mind when they struck that ballot poll.
But what it means for the organisation, based on your forecast, is $18 million or so less next year, and so the plan is to draw down on the reserves quite significantly.
Well, let's see. I modelled a $10 million drawdown on reserves just to give wool growers a little level of confidence that there wasn't any sort of fiscal cliff. Board of AWI will consider those items in the early part of next year and work towards getting a budget figure in May out. And I think there's no doubt they'll draw down on the reserves. To what level? I don't know yet.
So there's a gap there, isn't there? My maths are not great, but I'm guessing 8 to 10 million. So will that mean budget cuts, staff cuts?
No, look, we're going to try and manage the resources, the human resources and the dollar resources as best we can. I don't see the staff numbers growing at all in the next strategic period. Absolutely not. And, we've just got to be a bit smarter, a bit more efficient and think about things strategically.
AWI has been under significant pressure from the Federal Agriculture Minister. The federal government obviously contributes some funds. There was the Ernst & Young review. There was the list of recommendations, of which there are several that are still to be acted upon. And he wanted to see action by October 19, I think it was. But you've decided to push that out quite considerable length of time into next year.
I know there was 82 recommendations, 75 were completely agreed to. They have staging on them and timing on them all the way out for the next couple of years. So of the 75, we've completed 33, a third of those are done already. There are a few items there that will go to an EGM next year. We think that they are items that our shareholders deserve to have a say in.
And so things like the 10-year tenure, even the proxy votes, which was... I was interested to hear Colette say that she would be more transparent about those.
Yeah, look, there was a recommendation there about that, and I think the board's quite comfortable with the chair resolving at the start of the meeting what proxies they have and where they're going.
Stuart McCulloch. Robert Ingram, director of the Australian Wool Growers Association, or AUGA, said after the meeting he was glad to see the change of approach from the new chair, Colette Garnsey.
AUGA is very glad to hear from the new chair that they will engage and consult extensively with the wool grower stakeholders in the company, particularly in relation to going forward with the EY recommendations and those seven outstanding contentious ones. That's all we can ask for.
Really? I would have thought maybe your organisation could have asked for a change to the 10-year rule so you have more turnover, or a change to the way that proxy votes are handled, for example.
We could, but I would think that, you know, given the diverse opinions that exist, that, you know, consultation and agreement prior is the best way to go.
And could it be that maybe in the next period of time with Colette Garnsey in that chair role, we won't have some of the controversy, the man in the mirror, the way that proxy votes were handled and previewed, influence on the board and election of board members, suggestions about cronyism in terms of appointments of ex-staff or contractors. There was a lot of staff treatment of the media. Do you think that things might smoothen out a bit?
Given the background that Colette comes from, we think that she has a far greater understanding of how to engage across the whole constituency and, you know, look at what's being done in terms of due process and good governance.
That was Robert Ingram, Director of the Australian Wool Growers Association, ending that report by David Claughton. And before we get into news and weather, this is a fascinating little story. There's a lot of old farming properties and farming businesses in Australia, but, well, in South Australia in particular, given where we are. But how much do you actually know about what's gone on before you? Simon Hilda farms at Three Creeks Station at Craddock near Hawker and recently found just a treasure trove of documents hiding in the roof of the station. Old house. Now, these documents date back to the 20s and 30s and have given some clues about what life was like for Mr. Hilda's ancestors.
Old documents and receipts from the 20s and the 30s for a lot of wool receipts and retail receipts.
So these are documents about the history of your family business. Just what sort of things have you learnt from them?
Oh, what clothes cost back then and how much tax they paid and how many bales of wool every year, things like that.
So how'd you come across all these documents anyway?
They were renovating in our old laundry.
And your old laundry your old laundry is probably the oldest building on this station. Could you just tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was the original house. And yeah, we think this house was built in 1878. So yeah, that one could be a little bit earlier. We're not quite sure.
Looking at these documents, there's quite a few here. There's a receipt for watch repair. There are some mail orders, and there's a personal letter here. I think you said this was the only personal letter you'd found. Just who's it from, and what's it about?
Yeah, one from one of my dad's sisters that passed away before I ever got to meet her, and it was a letter she wrote to her mum about what it was like at school.
Can I ask, is that a bit surreal, seeing a letter from a person who passed away long before you could meet them?
Yeah, I heard, you know, quite a bit about her, and yeah, never got to meet her, but to find a letter that she wrote, yeah, it was pretty amazing.
You've been posting these on social media. What sort of response have you had to that?
Quite a few people have been interested and yeah, had a look at them. Yeah, it's my wife that actually put them on. But yeah, she's taken a few photos and put it on.
Does it give you any sort of clues as to what their lives must have been like?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, they didn't do a lot of travelling to shopping. It was mostly mail order and, yeah, things were delivered a lot.
And it's obviously been a pretty challenging season throughout a lot of South Australia and parts of and a lot of New South Wales and other parts of Australia. What's it been like here?
Yeah, pretty dry for quite a while.
Could you give me some sort of indication? What's your normal rainfall to this point this year compared to what it's actually been this year?
Our average is 11 inches in the old scale, and we've probably only had about 3.5 to 4 at the moment.
So what sort of impact has that had on your livestock here?
Oh, you just have to keep buying hay and keep lightening off, sell them.
Have you had to destock much?
Probably more than normal.
Could you give me some idea of how much?
Probably about close to 400, I suppose.
How much would you have in total?
Around about 900 to 1,000 usually.
And I understand there was a a moment where one of your ancestors died and a lot of their brands were transferred over. Would you just mind telling me about that, please?
The male boss, I suppose, you'd say, died and everything was transferred to his wife. All the, like the sheep brands, the trading name, the ear tags, like the earmarks.
Was that unusual in that time?
Possibly would have been, yeah. But to have a woman in charge back then would be, yeah, probably not the normal.
And that was your, what was it, your great-great-aunt or great-great-grandmother or something like that?
Yeah, it would have been the wife of my dad's grandfather. I think she did a pretty good job. She was very capable, yeah. I think that's why she was put in charge, because I think she was very capable.
What makes you say she was very capable?
Well, I guess she would have had to been with all the other brothers and males around that were in the partnership. If she was chosen as the one, she must have been the one.
I think that's probably a fair surmise by Simon Hilder there. He was speaking to Lucas Forbes. And if you want to see pictures of some of these documents, you can find them on the Three Creeks Station's Facebook page. We've also put up a story online on this as well. It's lovely to go back and see what's gone before you and see some of those records. They can make for some pretty fascinating reading. Just on this idea, though, that the farmers should have the ability to veto mining on arable land, Bill from the York Peninsula agrees. He says that farmers aren't against mining. They think it should remain on non-arable land and keep the 5% of valuable food-producing land for just that. And Alex from Maitland also believes that farmers should have the right of veto because he's not convinced that rehabilitation works as well. We would continue to like to get your thoughts on this. It's definitely a very topical issue in South Australia, and it is ahead of the bill being spoken about in Parliament tomorrow, supposedly, if all goes to plan. And you can text in on 0467922783 on the power of veto over arable farming land in this state. But we now need to head over to the news desk, and Samantha Johnshire's with us. Hi, Samantha.
Good afternoon, Cassie. Liberal Senator and Senate President Scott Ryan says the Victorian election results show traditional Liberal voters are abandoning the party. The Prime Minister is holding crisis talks with senior Victorians this morning as they digest the party's defeat at the weekend. Business owners across outback South Australia are calling for a Senate inquiry into how Telstra services the far north. It comes after pastoralists in the region lost Telstra landline services for 11 days. And the first deep-sea survey of the Great Australian Bight has revealed 400 new species of invertebrates. A team of researchers, partially funded by BP, has completed the six-year project ahead of planned oil exploration in the region. We'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Samantha. And still to come on the Country Hour, you might have been seeing in the news that there's some rising tensions in the Crimea. We'll take a look at whether this is impacting on grain markets in the next 5 minutes or so. But we have to find out what's happening in weather. We're joined by Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Cassie.
I know there's a lot of farmers battling to get a lot of crop in before this rain ban comes across. What's happening?
Yeah, look, we're starting to see a bit of activity out in the west at the moment, some thunderstorm activity, and that's just associated with a bit of a mid-level disturbance just ahead of a low-pressure system that's starting to just move into the northwest pastoral district at the moment. And we are expecting that low to continue moving across the north of the state over the next 24 hours. And it is going to produce a reasonable amount of shower and probably some patches of rain across mainly the south of the state over that next 24-hour period. So it has been a little bit tricky over the weekend. There's been some pretty dramatic changes in our model guidance over the last probably 48 to 72 hours. Initially, we were getting a little bit of a low-pressure system developing off the southwest coast of Kangaroo Island as we headed into tomorrow, but that significantly changed. So it's all the amount of rainfall and where that rainfall is going to fall has been sort of yo-yoing around quite a bit over the last couple of days. So we were looking at some quite considerable rainfall over sort of the Mount Lofty ranges, Adelaide, through that sort of band. But now it looks like most of the rainfall will be a bit further north, mainly over the sort of northern parts of the mid-north, north of Eyre Peninsula and the southern parts of the district, sorry, the pastoral districts. Still going to get some showers and rainfall elsewhere, sort of south of about Woomera, but I think most of that, most of the rainfall will be in that band that I just spoke of. So I think at this stage we'll probably be looking at generally where most of that activity is going to occur, falls around a sort of 10 to 15 millimetre mark, with elsewhere north of about Keith getting in that sort of maybe 5 to 10, with some places getting a little bit more and obviously some places getting a bit less. So yeah, it looks like a reasonable area of the south of state will get some rainfall. So it's going to make, as you say, conditions pretty tricky for those farmers that are cropping at the moment. But yeah, it's unfortunate that we're seeing that rainfall at this time of year, if that's going to cause some effects for the farmers. But once we get into sort of Tuesday evening, looks like most of the activity is going to push into the eastern states. We'll be left on Thursday with a little bit of shower activity around coastal fringes and southern agricultural area, just as the winds go into a southeasterly airstream. We've got a high pressure system moving across the Bight, so that's directing those southeasterly winds. So really just over windward facing coasts and ranges where we are expecting some shower activity, but not much as far as totals go, maybe up to a millimetre or so during that Wednesday period. As we head into Thursday, the high continues to move eastwards. Again, we might see just a very slight chance of a shower about the east coast of Eyre Peninsula and about southern coast. Start to see the possibility of just a bit of moisture feeding into the far west of the state just ahead of the next low pressure system. So there is a very slight chance of some showers and possible thunderstorms in the far northwest. But on Friday, we start to see a low approaching our border coming across from Western Australia. So by late evening, it's sort of sitting pretty close to the border of Western Australia, and it does push a bit of moisture a little bit further east. So again, there's a slight to medium chance of some shower and thunderstorm activity west of about Cooper Pedy. That trough continues to move eastwards during Saturday, so we'll see that shower activity just extending across the remaining parts of the state, and perhaps a bit of thunderstorm activity over the pastoral districts. But again, once that trough moves through, another high pressure system moves in, so we go back into that southeasterly airstream. So some showers about the agricultural area on Sunday, continuing on Monday, but another feed of moisture from the west could see some showers redeveloping over western parts on Monday. So yeah, a couple of reasonable systems moving through, pretty fast moving as well. So at this stage, it looks like the wettest of the days will be on Tuesday, but a little bit of follow-up rain over some parts of the state as we head into the weekend. So as I said, I think most of that rainfall will be over the northern agricultural areas and southern pastoral districts, with falls of around 5 to 15, perhaps a bit more in some areas. But generally speaking, anywhere south of about Woomera is expected to get some rainfall. And over the northeast pastoral district during the early morning as well, there is a chance of some early morning shower and thunderstorm activity, but not expecting too much as far as rainfall goes in that area. At the moment, we don't, we do have a coastal wind warning for the far west coast, but that's it at present. The thunderstorm activity in the far north today could get a little bit gusty, so we'll keep an eye on that to see whether we need to put out a severe thunderstorm warning for those thunderstorms. But other than that, it's just the rain tomorrow that is the focus of the forecast over the next few days.
Yeah, making things a bit interesting for people out there in the paddocks. Thanks for that,
yes.
Vince.
Okay, no worries.
That was Vince Rollins from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, it's going to be hot and mostly sunny tomorrow. There could be a thunderstorm there or some showers, and again, some dust around as well in the late afternoon and evening. The temperatures will fall to between 17 and 21 degrees, and the daytime temperatures will reach 34 to about 39 degrees. So getting hot there. The lower western will be partly cloudy. There is a medium chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm around in the afternoon and evening there as well. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 14 and 17, and the daytime temperatures will reach the low to mid 30s. And we've got Deb O'Callaghan with us to bring us up to date on everything that's happening around the country in agricultural news. And given she's a Victorian, she's pretty interested in this landslide result out of Victoria. What's piqued your interest?
Well, I think out of interest, we've been hearing a lot in the news about probably the massive swing to Labor, more so what it means, the massive swing away from the Liberals. And there is crisis meetings at the federal level at the moment going, well, what are they going to do leading into next year's election? So that's obviously of interest. At the moment, 71.3% of the vote are counted, 9 are still in doubt, but 52 to the ALP and 25 to Liberals and two others. The other interesting thing, Cass, that we were talking about this morning is the influence of the minor parties or the micro parties. And these are the ones that have claimed these seats in the upper house, which will give them some crossbench influence, including Darren Hinch's party, which if you'd have said this a couple of years ago, it wouldn't have been probably thinkable.
And yet the Greens lost seats.
That's right. So the Greens have gone backwards. So they've dropped back from 5 in the upper house to just 1, which is a slap in the face, really, for the Greens. And then, Darren Hinch has picked up 2 parties. Also, he's expected to pick up 4, but I think he's only going to get 2. There's also a party called the Transport Party, which was a protest party for disgruntled taxi drivers. It's likely to win 2 seats. The Aussie Battler Party, the Liberal Democrats, Sustainable Australia and the Animal Justice Party were all tipped to pick up a seat as well. I just find those sorts of conversations pretty amazing. So I thought
Interesting governing
for the next 4 years, yes.
And water as well, the all-important, ever-interesting water situation.
Yes, well, this is the one about theft, alleged theft. So the accused water thieves of the New South Wales cotton farming districts, they were the ones that were at the centre of the ABC investigation into water theft. They will face court today. That's Anthony, Margaret and Frederick Barlow. They were accused of illegally pumping water during an embargo. And while the meter wasn't working in the northwestern parts of New South Wales. So they are following that investigation by Four Corners in 2017. We're a long way down the track, but their trial starts this morning and is set down for the next 10 days. So we'll find out what happens there.
Thanks so much for that, Deb. Listening to The Country Hour, it is 19 minutes to 1.
I'm Greg Pattinson, CEO of Foodbank SA. Over 117,000 South Australians go hungry every month. One third of these are children. Hunger isn't something you see, it's something you feel. You can help the ABC and Foodbank to ensure that no one feels hungry this Christmas. Simply share what you can by donating a can of food at participating locations across South Australia and Broken Hill this Christmas, including the ABC studios. Visit Foodbank SA online for more information and help us end hunger in SA.
You might have seen and heard on the news today that tension has escalated in the Crimea region with reports that Russia has fired on and seized 3 Ukrainian naval vessels off the Crimean Peninsula. It's a move that risks igniting a new crisis between these countries. Last time this happened, wheat prices factored in the uncertainty and rose pretty substantially. I'm joined by Andrew Whitelaw from Mercator. Andrew, do you see this happening again?
Well, definitely it's... like you just said, it's a very tense situation in the Crimea, in the Black Sea, and that this is a continuation of the hostilities that have been really in place since mid-2014. And in reality, Russia and Ukraine are, for instance, this year going to be the most important wheat exporters in the world. So any sort of concerns that the trade might have, that there will be any forms of blockades or, heightened conflict, it means that there'll be a lot more risk factored into the market. So we've already seen this morning that prices have risen around about 1% in trading, which is usually a quiet time for trading because we're really at sort of 8 p.m. in the U.S. on a Sunday evening.
1% doesn't sound like that much. Are you expecting more?
Well, I think everyone, I guess, is looking at the same news and thinking, well, is this going to be escalated or will cooler heads prevail? But politicians in Ukraine have said that the Russians are effectively declaring war by doing this kind of incident. And the Ukrainian president has called for martial law, which would effectively restrict, you know, civil liberties and give state institutions a lot more power. So, you know, if we start to see things getting, you know, more tense or you know, more dangerous, I guess, then we will, yes, we'll definitely see, you know, very sharp movements upwards in pricing.
With the last USDA report, wheat prices actually went down because there was thought to be a bit more wheat around than expected. Do you think that given the significance of the Black Sea production, that this will change the overall USDA outlook as well?
Well, it's a little bit early to say what the USDA, how they'll reflect it, because at the moment there's been no real changes to the flow of movements of wheat. It really becomes a case of if there is, for instance, say a blockade and Ukrainian or Black Sea or Russian wheat is unavailable, then suddenly that is, you know, a huge impost on global trade, because suddenly, you know, the biggest exporter region in the world is no longer providing grain. So yes, that would have an impact if it gets worse.
And well, I guess it's going to be a bit of a wait and see to see how this all gets factored in. Have you just seen that price rise on the global situation? Are you seeing any of that reflected in Australian prices?
So we've seen that on in Chicago prices, and looking at it just now, really the market is relatively quiet so far in Australia, and I think if we see it reflected, that we probably won't see anything until, you know, later on this afternoon. We're probably starting the day unchanged from Friday to maybe a dollar or two up.
Thanks so much for that, Andrew.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew Whitelaw from Mercado, a grain analyst there, speaking about what this escalation of tension in the Crimea region could have on grain prices at a pretty crucial time for Australian producers. Moving away, though, from the grain to the sheep, where a Lower Eyre Peninsula farmer has said oui-oui to a French breed of sheep that he believes will be seen more frequently in years to come. Michael Harris farms at Copio, which has been breeding the Ile-de-France breed for about 3 years. The breed is named after the region it comes from near Paris, and Mr. Harris says he has incorporated them with his Merinos and Border Leicester breed.
I got in the breed because back a few years ago, I'm a lamb tailing contractor and was impressed with the young lambs at a very young age for their weight, so I thought I'd do a bit of research into them.
Where do they come from? It's not a breed that many people would have heard of.
No, they're actually in 1832 in a place called Ile-de-France, in not far from Paris. They crossed a Dishley Letzer ram over Merino ewe, and they spent 50 odd years crossbreeding until they come to this breed, and they end up naming it after the place, like Ile-de-France.
Do many people have them?
No. I think there's quite a few in the southeast and Victoria and stuff like that, because a place in Victoria called Ile-de-France Australia brought them out here, and I think there's a few over there, but on Eyre Peninsula in South Australia, I don't think there's a great amount of them.
When you first heard about them, what was the process of getting them over here to the Eyre Peninsula?
I inquired on them, and I was going to get some stud ewes over here, and I was in line to buying some, and then Eyre Peninsula, we had a little bit of a scare with foot rot from interstate, so I was a bit nervous about doing it that way, so I ended up doing it full embryo implants into Merino and Border Leicester ewes, so I introduced them that way. Yeah, I did that for 2 years, 2016 and 2017, and ended up with a small flock of ewes and sold the rams, and now I'm just naturally breeding. I've got 9 different families, so I can be a closed stud for quite a while with that many different families.
What sort of traits does the Ile-de-France have?
I suppose one of the best part of the Ile-de-France is that they have tiny little lambs, and they grow pretty fast after that, so they've got a very huge hind quarter, and they're stocky little things, but they've got smaller shoulders, so you don't have not much trouble with births. So I've actually mated 9-month-old Merino ewes to them and got 130% lamb out of them. So they were lambing at 14 months old and I didn't have any trouble with any of them. Similar to my border lesses, that there's a lot of twins and triplets. So yeah, they're similar like that, and they're very like strong, good mothers. So they handle it well.
And so where are you selling these sheep?
I'm trying to get them around and about to different areas and that, but the last lot went down to the southeast, and the lot beforehand went to Kangaroo Island. There's a few going around Eyre Peninsula, so I'm only slowly building up in my numbers, so it'll eventually hopefully get up to selling around about 40 rands a year.
And are they both meat and wool sheep?
Yeah, well, the wool's, of course, is not as good as Merino wool, but Micron's out around about 22 to 27. And then when you cross them over to a Merino, it's down to 20 to 23 micron. So, but yeah, the wool's okay. Probably the better of some of the British breeds, the wool is, I suppose.
And just in terms of, we had a look at some of the positives, but have you come across any negatives yet?
No, they can be a little bit flighty at times, but that's, I think that's similar to most of that type of breed. Like the Suffolks and that are, and the Dorsets are all a bit similar to that, but they handled a bit. The rams, they seem to be okay, and the crosses, there's no problem with them. And their performance on their meat is, I know local butchers down here, the River Meats and Eyre Peninsula, they prefer to use the Ile-de-France cross lambs because of their lean, not so much fat they have to cut off, especially when the lambs get up to around about 28 kilos dressed. There's very little trimmings to be done on them, so that's just come from them. So they're very impressed with using them.
In, say, you know, a year's time or even 5 years' time, where can you see this the Ile-de-France breed going?
Yeah, well, I think it's just sort of another, like, virtually in competition a bit with the Suffolks, but if you can produce a little bit better wool with the wool prices where they are, I think that's going to help a lot. And they, you know, their performance of fast growing, that's all got to be tested. I've got to test that, but I would say their growth is very, very good.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about the South African breeds getting traction in Australia. It's interesting to hear about a French breed coming here. That was Copio farmer Michael Harris speaking to Brooke Neindorf. We have had a text in to say, bring on the rain, we're in drought and are desperate for rain. No name there, but if you'd like to let us know what you're thinking about the weather or about the veto power for mining on arable land, you can text in on 0467 922 783. Finally today, scientists are looking at new ways to increase Australia's fruit production by up to 10 times. New multi-million dollar research is looking at the DNA of trees like citrus, almond and avocados to find smaller trees that will grow more fruit. University of Queensland Research Professor Dr. Robert Henry says there is huge potential for Australia's horticulture industry.
What we'll be doing is looking at the five major horticultural tree crops in Australia, the avocado, mango, macadamia, citrus and almond, studying their DNA so that we can better improve these crops. We're aiming, of course, in the longer term to dramatically improve the productivity of these crops and the quality of the products that we derive from them through a better understanding of their biology, but also much better support for the breeders of these crops.
How much potential is there to achieve that? Like, where's the Australian industry in regards to rootstocks that we see in the ground at the moment at?
Well, I think everyone agrees there's a lot of potential for further improvement on where we are now. We're in a good position in terms of our competitiveness, but we really need to improve for the future. What we're really looking at is taking these crops through the sort of path of intensification of production that's happened for some of the temperate or stone fruit products, where we've seen of the order of about tenfold improvements in productivity per hectare over a period of a number of decades. And what we want to do is the same thing for these crops of great importance to Australia.
What are major challenges for growers currently, like with the trees that they have in the ground?
Well, I think the big challenge is that we're still growing fairly large trees, well spaced, and that creates challenges when we're wanting to harvest them or to do anything with them, really. The opportunity to move to higher density plantings. Effectively, we want more fruit and nuts and less trees, and that way we'll improve the productivity and intensify production in the longer term. And these changes could be quite dramatic in the competitiveness of these industries.
And with this new research project, are you also looking at making the trees more water efficient?
We'll be looking at the whole range of traits, and what we're doing is involving growers of each of these crops to really prioritise which of the characteristics of the crop is of most importance to the Australian industry. And so what we'll develop is a platform that would allow us to be more efficient in tackling really any of those challenges that they may have, and then we'll apply it in a way that's prioritised by the industry themselves.
And with the 5-year time frame, are we expecting then to see growers having access to these new plant genetics after these 5 years, or do these rootstocks then first need to be produced?
Of course, with tree crops, it does take longer. Trees take a while to grow, and one of the things this project will be tackling is trying to shorten that time that it takes us to get a tree crop into production. That will be a real priority across the program. What we will expect is that there'll be some outcomes within the 5-year period where we'll potentially have identified material from existing populations that can be brought into production. But really the benefits of this will be long-term and sustained across all of these industries, where we hope that we'll be seeing better varieties coming to market faster in the longer term.
Chairman for Citrus Australia, Ben Cairns, says citrus growers are always looking at ways to make their trees more efficient.
So certainly there's a very strong focus at the moment around, and as there has always been, about efficiency. So efficiency of inputs, be that water, fertilizer, labor, and then generating the highest amount of yield out of those inputs to obviously generate the most dollars back to the farm for the inputs provided.
As there is a new research program underway looking at plant genetics and pretty much looking at improving the trees, yielding and productivity, what outcomes are growers and the industry hoping for?
Well, certainly, yeah, we'll be looking to any outcomes that improve the efficiency of those inputs, and also potentially whether there's any performance improvements in the attributes of the fruit that's produced by those trees, be it lower seed numbers or smoother skin or greater shelf life. So we certainly am approaching that with some interest.
And if this new research project actually can, in the end, breed trees that are yielding, like seeing higher yields, could that also be a challenge, though, to like national and international markets when we all of a sudden see more fruit actually come onto the market?
At the moment in citrus, we have greater export demand than we're able to produce. And so certainly, and in the world stage, we're actually a smaller niche producer of fruit, a high quality, low volume producer. And so there is a significant market opportunity for us to grow and ship more fruit to export destinations, particularly our Asian trading partners.
Chairman of Citrus Australia, Ben Cant, speaking with Jessica Schremer there. And just an update since Rural News, those cotton farmers who are at the centre of alleged water theft and corruption allegations have pled guilty in a New South Wales court today. Anthony Barlow has pled guilty, and Mr. Barlow's parents have also been charged with pumping water under the embargo, but those charges were dropped today. They were named as part of the ABC Four Corners report in 2017, which uncovered those allegations that some irrigators were using billions of litres of water illegally in the Barwon-Darling system in New South Wales. So there you go, a bit of guess closure on that issue. We'll get what's happening in the cattle markets, though, now with John Traeger.
Good afternoon. Prices lifted as agents offered just over 400 head of live weight cattle to the usual field of trade and processor buyers, especially butchers and restockers. Quality was arguably the best seen here for several months, with strong trade competition keeping restockers generally unable to compete as prices lifted by from 5 to 10 cents on average across the market, with only grown steers and heifers remaining firm on the previous sale. Light velar steers made 230 to 290, with heavier weights selling from 290 to 302 cents, while light C3 velar heifers ranged from 230 to 264 cents. Light yielding steers range from 240 to 266 cents, with C3 descriptions of the trade making 228 to a top of $3 a kilo. Light yielding heifers made 208 to 244 cents. Medium weight C3 heifers sold from 220 to 260 cents, with heavier weights topping at 260 cents a kilo. Grown steers range from 210 to 290 cents, with dairy types selling to 186 cents, with grain heifers of mostly heavier weights selling from 170 to top of 246 cents a kilo. Light cows sold from 140 to 160 cents, medium weights made 158 to 210 cents, with a good selection of heavier weight cows selling from 170 to a top of 222 cents a kilo.
That was John Traeger. Thanks for that. Right now, though, it's coming up to news time, as it is almost 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.